When I discovered I was pregnant during an economics conference, my first thought wasn't about baby names or nursery colors. It was about my morning coffee. Could I still have it? What about the wine at the conference reception? As an economics professor at the University of Chicago with a PhD, I was trained to analyze data and make evidence-based decisions. Yet the pregnancy advice I encountered was frustratingly arbitrary and contradictory. This disconnect launched me on a journey to apply economic decision-making principles to pregnancy. The book quickly became a sensation among educated mothers-to-be, with celebrities like Emily Blunt and Amy Schumer citing it as their pregnancy Bible. Time magazine called it the pregnancy book for economics nerds, while the Wall Street Journal praised its refreshingly factual approach. By challenging conventional wisdom with hard data, I created what the New York Times described as a more relaxed, less rigid approach to pregnancy, one that's transformed how a generation of women experience this life-changing journey. The journey to motherhood begins long before pregnancy itself. Despite spending my 20s trying not to get pregnant, when my husband Jesse and I decided to start a family, I worried about my ability to conceive. My doctor suggested learning more about the process might help me relax. What I discovered was fascinating. Conception requires remarkably precise timing. In a typical 28-day cycle, ovulation occurs around day 14, when the egg is released and begins traveling toward the uterus. This egg is only available for fertilization for about 24 hours. For successful pregnancy, sperm must be waiting when the egg starts its journey, making the day before or day of ovulation the optimal time for conception. Research tracking couples trying to conceive showed the window for conception is surprisingly narrow, just 6 days total, spanning from 5 days before ovulation through the day of ovulation itself. No pregnancies resulted from sex after ovulation, the egg disappears too quickly, or more than 5 days before. The highest conception rates, over 30%, occur when having sex on the day before or day of ovulation. This precision timing becomes even more challenging when coming off birth control. When I stopped taking the pill, my cycles became irregular rather than immediately returning to normal as my doctor had suggested. German studies found some women take up to 9 months to establish regular cycles after stopping hormonal contraception. During this adjustment period, cycles tend to be longer, ovulation may not occur in some cycles, or the luteal phase might be too short for successful implantation. With irregular cycles, I needed reliable methods to detect ovulation. Temperature charting tracks the body's slight temperature increase, about half a degree, after ovulation, but only confirms ovulation after it happens. Studies show this method correctly identifies ovulation day only about 30% of the time. Cervical mucus monitoring involves checking for stretchy, egg white consistency mucus that appears near ovulation, correctly identifying the fertile window in 34 to 50% of cases. Ovulation detection kits offer the most accurate solution by detecting luteinizing hormone, LH, surges in urine, indicating when ovulation will occur within the next 48 hours. Research shows they increase pregnancy rates, 23% versus 15% without them. The downside is cost, $30 to $40 monthly, but for many women trying to conceive, the precision is worth it. After ovulation comes the frustrating 2-week wait before pregnancy can be confirmed. Modern pregnancy tests can detect pregnancy remarkably early, up to 5 days before a missed period. This is a dramatic improvement from historical methods, Egyptians urinating on grains, and even from the 1970s-80s when women typically confirmed pregnancy around 5 weeks. The downside to early detection is increased awareness of early pregnancy loss. Studies from the 1980s found that 22% of pregnancies ended in miscarriage before detection by standard methods at that time. The moment I confirmed my pregnancy, I received a long list of food and beverage restrictions that seemed overwhelming. Beyond alcohol and caffeine limits, there were countless forbidden foods: hot dogs, raw oysters, deli meats, lox, rare steak, sushi, and more. The restrictions seemed inconsistent and confusing. My doctor saw no issue with prosciutto, while internet lists banned it as a deli meat. As an economist, I realized my training was uniquely suited to evaluate this research. While medical professionals often rely on policy briefs, I went directly to the academic literature and applied the statistical methods I used to analyze observational data. I discovered that official recommendations were extremely cautious, often too cautious, and failed to distinguish between moderate consumption and excess. Take alcohol, for instance. A large Australian study classified women into 5 drinking groups and found no evidence that light or occasional drinking led to higher levels of behavioral problems in children. In fact, light drinkers, up to 1 drink daily, were significantly less likely to have children with behavior problems than abstainers. Another Australian study, tracking 7,200 women, found children of light drinkers actually scored slightly higher on IQ tests at age 14 than those of non-drinkers. Many studies consistently show no negative impact of light drinking on child development. A large Danish study showed no effect of drinking up to 8 drinks weekly on child IQ at age 5. Studies in Denmark and Italy found light drinkers were actually less likely to have premature babies than non-drinkers. For caffeine, the primary concern is increased miscarriage risk. However, multiple studies, including a Maryland study tracking daily consumption and a larger study of 2,400 women, found no relationship between moderate caffeine consumption, up to 3 to 4 cups daily, and miscarriage. A Danish study of nearly 100,000 women similarly found no impacts from up to 3 cups daily. Unlike alcohol and caffeine, tobacco isn't recommended to anyone at any time. For pregnant women, there's overwhelming evidence to quit. Smoking significantly increases risks of preterm labor, placental problems, and low birth weight babies. A massive study analyzing over 1 million Missouri births found smokers had significantly higher rates of complications across the board. Most dramatically, 17.08% of smokers had small for gestational age babies compared to just 7.47% of non-smokers. Regarding food safety, most pregnancy food restrictions stem from concerns about food contamination, but not all foodborne bacteria pose equal risk during pregnancy. 3 common bacteria, Salmonella, E. coli, and Campylobacter, cause unpleasant stomach flu symptoms but aren't significantly more dangerous during pregnancy than otherwise. However, toxoplasmosis and listeria are genuine pregnancy concerns, with listeria being particularly dangerous. After analyzing listeria outbreaks, I realized the risk isn't concentrated in just a few foods. Recent major outbreaks occurred in celery, cantaloupes, sprouts, and ice cream, not the commonly restricted deli meats. My data-driven approach narrowed the restricted food list to just raw, rare meat and unwashed produce, toxoplasmosis risk, plus queso fresco and deli turkey. Even before my pregnancy, my mother-in-law Joyce shared stories of her severe morning sickness. With her first child, she found relief with Bendictin, but when this drug was removed from the market before her second pregnancy, she suffered continuously, gaining only 18 pounds. While her experience was unusually severe, pregnancy nausea is extremely common and uniquely challenging. Nearly 90% of women experience some nausea, and over half experience vomiting, typically peaking around weeks 8-9 and gradually declining thereafter. Despite its name, morning sickness is a misnomer. Over 80% of women report feeling sick throughout the day. Counterintuitively, nausea actually signals a healthy pregnancy, with studies showing significantly lower miscarriage rates among nauseated women, 8% versus 30% for those without nausea. This biological protection mechanism may prevent women from consuming potentially harmful substances during crucial developmental periods. When simple remedies like eating small meals and having crackers before getting out of bed prove insufficient, women often seek alternative treatments before medications. However, evidence for holistic remedies is limited. Acupuncture and acupressure show no proven benefits, while ginger has minimal supporting evidence. Vitamin B6 does demonstrate effectiveness against mild nausea, but doesn't help with vomiting. For stronger relief, the history of prescription medications is complicated. Bendictin, once effective and later proven safe, was removed from the market due to lawsuits despite FDA approval. Today, women can recreate it by combining vitamin B6 and Unisom. For severe cases, medications like promethazine and Zofran appear safe and effective, though many women avoid asking for medication due to concerns about pregnancy drug use, a potentially dangerous choice when dehydration and weight loss pose real risks. The first major medical decision in pregnancy involves prenatal screening for chromosomal abnormalities. This deeply personal choice requires weighing various factors based on individual values rather than following standard recommendations. Modern prenatal testing offers multiple approaches. Traditional invasive procedures like amniocentesis and chorionic villus sampling, CVS, provide definitive results but carry miscarriage risks. Newer screening methods include combined ultrasound blood tests and more recent blood tests that sequence fetal DNA. These screening options carry no miscarriage risk but can't provide absolute certainty about chromosomal status. The newest technology, cell-free fetal DNA screening, analyzes fetal DNA fragments in maternal blood. This method detects about 99.1% of Down syndrome cases with an extremely low false positive rate of just 0.05%. For a 35-year-old woman with a negative test result, the remaining risk of Down syndrome is only about 1 in 45,000, while a positive result indicates over 80% chance of the condition. While cell-free fetal DNA testing has become increasingly common, it's often not covered by insurance except for women over 35 who are considered high risk. The older screening technology combines an ultrasound measurement of nuchal translucency, fluid behind the baby's neck, with blood tests for hormone levels. This combination detects about 90% of Down syndrome cases versus 99% for newer tests, but with a much higher false positive rate of 6.3% compared to just 0.05%. Invasive testing offers definitive chromosomal analysis but carries a small risk of miscarriage. Both procedures involve extracting fetal cells with a needle. Amniocentesis samples amniotic fluid at 16-20 weeks, while CVS samples placental cells at 10-12 weeks. Despite commonly cited risks of 1 in 200 for amniocentesis and 1 in 100 for CVS, modern studies suggest much lower risks, around 1 in 800 for both procedures. The traditional approach to genetic testing recommendations was based solely on maternal age, with invasive testing offered to women over 35. This arbitrary cutoff came from comparing the historical 1 in 200 risk of miscarriage from amniocentesis with the approximately 1 in 200 risk of chromosomal problems at age 35. From a decision perspective, this logic is fundamentally flawed. It assumes everyone values avoiding a child with chromosomal issues and avoiding miscarriage equally. In reality, these preferences vary dramatically between individuals and families. This section explores seemingly arbitrary pregnancy restrictions that aren't obvious from common sense, examining the evidence behind various prohibitions like avoiding cat litter, hair dye, hot tubs, and certain activities. The concern with cat litter is toxoplasmosis, the same parasite found in undercooked meat. Despite widespread warnings, studies show cat litter isn't actually a significant source of infection. Cats only excrete the parasite during their first exposure, after which they develop immunity. Research comparing pregnant women with and without toxoplasmosis found no association with cat ownership or litter box cleaning. Surprisingly, gardening poses a much higher risk. Working with soil showed strong associations with toxoplasmosis infection, suggesting pregnant gardeners should wear gloves and possibly masks. While hair dye chemicals can cause birth defects in rodents at extremely high doses, human studies show no association with birth defects from normal hair coloring. Most medical reviews, including guidance from the American Congress of Obstetrics and Gynecologists, conclude hair dye is safe after the first trimester. Activities that significantly raise body temperature above 101 degrees during early pregnancy may increase risk of birth defects, particularly neural tube defects like spina bifida and anencephaly. A study of 11,000 babies with birth defects found associations between hot tub use and certain defects, supported by animal studies. Hot environments like Bikram yoga, 105 degrees, pose similar concerns during the first trimester when neural tube formation occurs. Air travel is generally safe during pregnancy before 36 weeks, after which many airlines restrict travel to avoid in-flight deliveries. While cosmic radiation exposure increases at higher altitudes, typical flights contribute minimal radiation. A Chicago to Boston flight delivers only about 1% of the recommended pregnancy limit, 1 MSV. Even long international flights remain well below dangerous levels, with studies showing no difference in outcomes between pregnant women who flew and those who didn't. The myth of eating for two during pregnancy quickly collides with reality when pregnant women face strict weight monitoring at doctor appointments. Many women feel frustrated by the focus on weight gain despite their best efforts to follow guidelines. Weight gain during pregnancy affects both mother and child. Studies show women who gain recommended amounts retain about 5 pounds postpartum, while those exceeding guidelines retain around 17 pounds. However, 90% of women who started at normal weight return to normal range by 24 months, regardless of pregnancy weight gain. The connection between maternal weight gain and childhood obesity shows minimal impact. Studies suggest gaining 10 pounds over recommendations would increase a child's BMI by only about 0.13, equivalent to roughly 1 pound for an average height person. Weight gain during pregnancy directly impacts baby size. The more weight gained, the larger the baby is likely to be relative to gestational age. Babies who are too large, LGA, or too small, SGA, face health risks, with SGA babies experiencing more serious complications, including breathing problems, blood sugar regulation issues, and neurological complications. Studies show women gaining less than recommended are more likely to have SGA babies, while those gaining more have higher LGA rates. Despite doctors' focus on not exceeding guidelines, evidence suggests the risks of gaining too little actually outweigh those of gaining too much. The recommendations themselves may be flawed, as they aim to minimize total abnormal-sized babies rather than minimize serious complications. Small deviations from guidelines, a few pounds over, have minimal impact, so pregnant women should worry less about precise numbers and focus more on healthy eating patterns and moderate activity. Exercise and sleep become increasingly difficult as pregnancy progresses. Though tempting to abandon exercise entirely, the evidence suggests moderate activity remains beneficial. Exercise typically leads to slightly less weight gain during pregnancy, about 1.3 pounds less on average, according to a 2010 review of 12 randomized trials. Beyond weight management, comprehensive reviews show exercise during pregnancy doesn't significantly impact outcomes like preterm birth, gestational age, C-section rates, fetal growth, APGAR scores, or labor length. While there's no strong reason to start exercising during pregnancy, there's also no reason to stop if you're already active. Kegel exercises strengthen the pelvic floor muscles, the same ones used to stop urination midstream. In a 2011 randomized trial from Taiwan, 300 women were divided into two groups. 150 performed Kegel exercises, three sets of 8 repetitions twice daily, holding each for 6 seconds, while 100 served as controls. Women who did Kegels showed significantly better urinary control during late pregnancy and up to 6 months postpartum. Additionally, one small study showed Kegel practitioners spent slightly less time pushing during delivery, 40 versus 45 minutes average. Despite personally disliking yoga, the author acknowledges evidence supporting prenatal yoga's benefits. Small studies from Taiwan and Thailand showed reduced discomfort in late pregnancy and significantly shorter labor times, 2.5 hours less in first stage. Sleeping normally during pregnancy becomes nearly impossible, despite body pillows and other accommodations. The author questions the common advice to avoid back sleeping after 20 weeks, citing research that found no negative impact on blood flow to the uterus when lying on one's back. For sleep aids, Unisom, Category B, is considered safe during pregnancy, while Ambien shows good but less conclusive safety evidence. As pregnancy progresses past the worry of premature birth, women often become convinced they'll be pregnant forever, especially as due dates come and go. Most first-time mothers actually deliver about 8 days after their supposed due date without intervention. About 30% of babies are born in the 39th week of pregnancy, with week 38, 18%, and week 40, 17% following. Approximately 70% of babies arrive before their due date, though first births tend to be later. For women still pregnant at their due date, there's a 60% chance of delivery within the next week. Medical induction of labor has increased dramatically, from less than 10% of births in 1990 to 25% by 2008. This trend has actually shortened average pregnancy length in the U.S., with only 33% of births now occurring on or after the due date, down from 55% in 1980. Between doing nothing and medical induction lies the realm of DIY labor encouragement methods. While most lack scientific evidence, they're popular among women eager to avoid medical induction. Red raspberry leaf tea, despite centuries of midwife recommendations, shows no impact on labor timing or duration. Evening primrose oil, sometimes doctor recommended, actually increase risks of premature water breaking in studies. Nipple stimulation genuinely works. Studies show 37% of women entered labor within 3 days versus 6% without it, but requires significant time commitment, 1 to 3 hours daily. Labor may be brief compared to pregnancy, but commands outsized attention as the most medical, decision-heavy, and intimidating part. Labor progresses through three distinct stages. The first stage, cervical dilation, from closed to 10 centimeter, is longest and subdivided into early labor, 0 to 3 centimeter, mild contractions, active labor, 3 to 7 centimeter, more intense, and transition, 7 to 10 centimeter, most difficult with contractions every 2 minutes. The timing of labor varies considerably between women. Early labor, 0 to 3 centimeter, can stretch over weeks, often unnoticed. More recent 2002 research from Hawaii studying 1,300 women found slower average rates than previously believed, 1 to 2 centimeters per hour during active labor, with nearly 6 hours to progress from 3 to 7 centimeter, but only 90 minutes for transition, 7 to 10 centimeter. Importantly, women may experience 2 to 3 hour periods with no apparent dilation before 7 centimeter, which can be frustrating but is completely normal.
I struggle with the natural birth movement's argument that home births are better because women have delivered at home for thousands of years. While true, historically, many women and babies died during childbirth. Hospital births in developing countries have dramatically reduced maternal and infant mortality through emergency interventions, antibiotics, and professional care. Home births offer several advantages for low-risk women who want to avoid epidurals. You won't face hospital pressure to accept pain medication, and your familiar environment may help you feel more relaxed, potentially making labor faster and easier. Research shows planned home births involve fewer medical interventions, less monitoring, fewer episiotomies, forceps deliveries, and C-sections. Women also experience fewer vaginal tears and lower infection rates compared to hospital births. The most serious risk of home birth is the potential for infant death. A controversial meta-analysis suggested infant death rates are 2 to 3 times higher with home births, 2 per 1,000 versus 0.9 per 1,000, though the absolute risk remains extremely small. This study sparked intense debate, with the home birth community attacking it from all angles. Upon closer examination, the paper contained calculation errors and methodological issues. The research remains inconclusive, with contradictory findings across studies. If choosing home birth, selecting a properly trained attendant is crucial. Not all midwife credentials are equal. Certified nurse midwives, CNMs, represent the highest level of training. They have nursing degrees plus midwifery certification from the American College of Nurse Midwives. The medical literature confirms this hierarchy matters. Even studies showing increased risks with home births found no evidence of increased risk when births were supervised by certified nurse midwives. Despite having a friend who advocated for home birth and having previously delivered without medication, I couldn't accept even the tiny potential risk of complications. I chose a hospital birthing center with a tub and minimal monitoring. My friend Dwyer took the opposite approach. She acknowledged the small increased risk, but felt it was outweighed by the benefits of fewer interventions. The decision ultimately comes down to personal risk tolerance and priorities.
After delivering Penelope early in the morning, I stayed in the hospital for 2 nights. On the second night, a nurse announced she'd lost 11% of her birth weight, exceeding their 10% limit. I was told we'd need to supplement with formula to take her home the next day. Despite my commitment to breastfeeding, my exhausted new mom brain couldn't bear the thought of not bringing my baby home, while my researcher mind questioned the arbitrary cutoff between 10% and 11%. This moment perfectly encapsulated my entire pregnancy experience, caught between medical protocols that often lack strong evidence and my own desire to make informed, personalized decisions. Throughout pregnancy, I discovered that many standard recommendations are based on minimal evidence, outdated research, or an abundance of caution rather than clear risk-benefit analysis. The economist's approach to pregnancy, gathering data, weighing personal preferences, and making an informed choice offers a powerful alternative to the world of arbitrary rules with little explanation. By getting to the actual data, I found myself in a more relaxed place about pregnancy decisions. This approach extends beyond pregnancy into parenting itself. As I called my husband to bring my textbook and computer to the hospital, I realized the real decision-making was just beginning. Parenthood would bring countless more situations requiring evidence-based analysis rather than blind adherence to conventional wisdom. The skills I developed during pregnancy, finding and evaluating research, distinguishing correlation from causation, and making personalized decisions based on my own values, would serve me well in the years of parenting ahead.